Well, if I may have your attention, please. Everybody got a seat. Almost everybody got a seat. Well, we could have filled the theatre many times, which is a great tribute to how pleased we are, a testimony to how pleased we are to have you here. But before the director, Tony Giddens, introduces Joseph Stiglitz, this is a sort of sequence, I'm not going to introduce Tony Giddens. I'd just like to say a few words about the lecture series of which today is a part. Everybody okay before I start? Joseph Stiglitz will give the opening lecture of our Miliband series on global economic governance. The theme running through the series is the relationship between processes of economic globalization on the one hand and the problem of their regulation, coordination, and accountability on the other. In each and every lecture, dimensions of this broad theme will be explored. You'll find on the table outside there to the right, if you haven't already done so, a list of the first five confirmed lectures in this series. Apart from today, of course, we're pleased to have Robert Wade talking about economic globalization, inequality, and debt on February the 27th. Robert Goodin talking to the theme of global justice on March the 20th. Robert Cohen analyzing issues on global governance and democratic accountability on May the 17th. And John Ruggie on global governance and corporate responsibility on June the 6th. As I said, full details on the table outside, and everybody here is welcome to come to each and every one of those lectures. After the summer break, the series will continue, and I've invited some of the leading anti-globalization critics, including Naomi Klein, to come and present their ideas. We might call that series tentatively Global Critics Criticized, because I hope to present them with some of the leading critics of their ideas, so we'll have an exchange, as it were, between the leading critics of globalization and some of those who are skeptical of the critics' views. A final word by way of introduction as to why this series is called the Miliband Public Lecture Series. The lectures remember and honor the name of Ralph Miliband, who taught at the LSE. He was born in Brussels in 1924 and died in London in 1994. He studied here with Harold Laski and was made a lecturer in 1948. He taught at the LSE until 1972, at which point he took up a chair elsewhere. He was the author of numerous works, the best known of which were probably The State and Capitalist Society and Socialism for a Skeptical Age. And many of these books, 20, 30 years, were defining texts, and they certainly were in my academic career. Ralph Miliband was dedicated to thinking about and analyzing themes very close to today's lecture series. Themes concerned with the accountability of economic power, the interrelationship between economic and political interests, and the defense of the best of egalitarian doctrines. He left a very remarkable heritage. When he died, one of his former students left a considerable sum of money to help the LSE to continue the work that Ralph was committed to. Those resources are making this lecture series possible, and I'm very grateful to them. I'm also very grateful to the Global Dimensions Program based at the LSE at the Center for Global Governance, for they too have helped fund particularly today's lecture. Before handing over to the director, I want to thank Matthias Koenig-Archibugi sitting over there, who's been an absolutely enormous help in pulling this lecture series together. It's amazing how a simple idea of a lecture series creates an absolutely formidable amount of administration. So especially a thank you to him.
Well, let me add my welcome to everyone here this evening and say how pleased and proud we are to have Joe Stiglitz back at the LSE. He tells me he last was here a year ago. I think that was when I had a sabbatical term, so I unfortunately missed it, so I'm really looking forward to it tonight. Professor Stiglitz is, by any reckoning, one of the leading economic thinkers in the world. He has made fundamental contributions in a diversity of areas of economics, including microeconomic issues, labor economics, financial economics, and the economics of development. I was just looking at his intellectual bio earlier this afternoon, and it is completely amazing. I mean, if there's anyone more distinguished in any subject, I'd very much like to meet them and see what they could possibly be like. It's an extraordinary career to date. Professor Stiglitz's distinction was recognized by the award of a Nobel Prize for Economics in 2001. The award cited his particular contribution to the analysis of markets with asymmetric information. He is no ivory tower thinker. He was a member and later chairman of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisers. Subsequently, he was chief economist of the World Bank between 1997 and 2000. We have the current chief economist of the World Bank sitting somewhere in the audience, Nick Stern. We're very pleased, there he is, waving away. We're very pleased to welcome him back to the LSE too. Professor Stiglitz is currently at the Graduate School of Business at Columbia University in New York. The title of his lecture today, as it says up there, is Globalization and Development. Perfect title for the LSE. Please give him a very warm welcome.
Thank you for that introduction. One of the advantages of a title like that, Globalization and Development, it doesn't constrain one very much. Half the world is concerned with globalization, half the world is concerned with development, and since I can have everything within that. But it also makes the difficulty of this task, but trying to talk about even a few of the more salient issues. The issue of development is, of course, one of the most important challenges facing the world today. Approximately 20% of the world's population living on less than a dollar a day, 50% on less than $2 a day, the challenges are enormous. What we've seen in the last half century is that development is possible, that what has been accomplished, say, in the countries of East Asia is far stronger than anybody would have expected 50 years ago. Incomes in a country like Korea have increased eightfold. Friends of mine who visited Korea more recently have noted that 40 years ago, India and Korea had income per capita that were roughly comparable, and today Korea's is 8 times that of India. So while development is clearly possible, it's far from inevitable. And in fact, in parts of the world, in Africa, incomes have steadily declined since independence. The hopes that the end of colonialism would bring with them a renewed prosperity have for the most part been dashed. There have been a few exceptions. There has been steady growth in a couple countries, small countries like Botswana, but those are a rarity. This fall, I spent a lot of time in Latin America, and I want to begin by talking a little bit about some of my impressions from those trips to Latin America. The optimism that was quite prevalent in Latin America at the beginning of this decade and through the middle of the decade of the 90s has now been shattered. The early 90s saw relatively rapid growth in most of the countries in Latin America. There were democratic reforms, and there were also marked policy changes. But beginning in 95, and then even more so with the global economic crisis in 97, country after country faced recession, stagnation, or worse. The most recent example has been Argentina. The question that is being debated in much of Latin America is whether reform has failed Latin America or has globalization failed Latin America. In some sense, though, those two issues are really the same issue, because a key part of the reform agenda was globalization. As people have begun to look at these experiences more closely, there is a new view of the whole reform movement that began in the early that characterized the early 90s. The rapid growth of that first half of that decade can be seen today as little more than a partial catch-up of the lost decade of the 1980s, it itself a consequence of mismanagement of the debt crisis by the IMF at the beginning of the 1980s. The growth that occurred in the early 90s not only was a little more than a catch-up, it also appears to have been unsustainable. It exposed countries to enormous risks, risks for which they were not capable of adapting. Argentina, as I say, the most recent failure, was for a long time the poster child of the IMF and the United States. The experience has shown to a large extent that these institutions are fair weather friends. They'll stick by you when things are going well, but when things look bad, they bring out all kinds of criticisms for why what you did was incomplete, not enough, and it was your own fault and you deserved it. It's slightly unfair what I just said, but only slightly so. In the summer, in August, the IMF did give Argentina $8 billion, which is not a modest sum. It always reminds me that you know, we work very hard, and this expression, you know, penny wise, pound foolish, we work very, where the pound is the English pound. We work very hard to tell countries they have to spend their money well. But if you look at the amounts that have been squandered in the misguided attempts to maintain overvalued exchange rates in Argentina, in Brazil, in Russia, we're talking about magnitudes that amount to $10, $50, $100 billion. So at a snap of a finger, you can throw away $100 billion, but then you criticize countries for misspending $100,000 or $1 million. Argentina, as I say, represents the latest of these, and the experience there actually is very telling. I had the opportunity right after that experience and over the subsequent months to talk to a number of the executive directors of the IMF, or the people who make the decisions about the representatives of the governments of the United States and other countries who make the decisions about allocating, about these large bailouts. One has to put these bailouts in perspective. A lot of the rhetoric has it that it's the American taxpayers and the taxpayers in the UK that are putting out the money. But that is wrong. The money is almost always repaid. It comes out of the pockets of the taxpayers in the countries affected. So when the United States in 1998, when the IMF in 1998 lent Russia $6 billion, and that money the next day wound up in Cyprus and Swiss bank accounts, It wasn't the money from the IMF or the United States that really is lost. It's Russian taxpayers that will have to repay that money. Those are debts. So it's not a gift. It's a loan, and that loan will be repaid. And you can always be more generous with the money of other countries. In the case of Argentina, the United States government, the new Bush O'Neill administration, had railed against the big bailouts that had characterized the Clinton administration, and I think quite rightly. But when it came to Argentina, they were willing to try another time. The executive directors knew it wouldn't work. One of them said to me, well, it's a going away present for Stan Fisher, LSE's own product. An $8 billion present. He described it as it would last for, Stan Fisher was leaving the next week. He said it will last for that week. He said it was after the failures of Russia, Thailand, Indonesia, Korea, Brazil, he didn't want Stan Fisher to have another failure chalked up to his credit. But he said this 1AD was planning to leave in a few months' time. He was worried that it was not going to last until his departure. In fact, the good news was it lasted for about 4 weeks after his departure. But the fact was that got this from more than one executive director, it was recognized that the probability that it would work was very, very low. The only circumstance in which it might have worked was a crash of the U.S. dollar. And if the dollar crashed, since the Argentina's currency was linked with the dollar, their currency would be devalued, and they would be able to export a little bit more. So I don't know if they were actually praying for a fall of the dollar or hoping that it might occur, or maybe it would occur on somebody else's watch. But the fact is, the failures were predictable, and they were predicted. And in the meanwhile, the $8 billion did what the kind of money has done in country after country. It allows the rich a little bit extra time to take their money out of the country at a more favorable exchange rate, because one of the parts of the dogma is to maintain free convertibility. So you can take your pesos, convert them into dollars, you get a better exchange rate than if you wait until after the crash, and then you get fewer dollars. So it allowed a few more people to get a few more Argentinians to get their money out, a few American banks to get repaid. But the overall consequences for Argentina are all the worse, because as it goes into as it went into default, it has all the more liabilities in dollar denominated liabilities that it has to deal with. The picture in Argentina, of course, is only the most dramatic. Throughout Latin America and throughout much of the world, the question is, the view is that globalization and the reform have failed. In countries like Bolivia, they ask the following question. We've done everything that you told us to do. You were right that there would be a large amount of pain. We felt that pain. But when do we get the benefits? And they're waiting. They see an unfair agenda. They, in the case of Bolivia, they did fight the drug war. They eradicated cocaine, their cocaine fields, which lowered their income significantly. But the United States maintained its high tariffs against its products, and they still do not allow have very restricted exports of sugar into the United States. These are crops and products which would compensate them for what they have done. All they see is the pain and very little gain. As one looks at the statistics, one sees a very similar picture. If you look at the whole decade, or in particular the two decades of the reform era, the growth in that reform era is lower or a little better than in the pre-reform eras of the 50s and 60s. Now, to be sure, people said that those earlier periods, the 50s and 60s, growth was not sustainable, and it wasn't sustained. But that's exactly what people said about the reform movements of the 1990s. Growth was not sustainable, and it was not sustained. And so, as I say, that the issue of the impact of the reforms and the globalization has become a very live issue of debate in Latin America. Let me turn now to the issue of globalization. The idea of globalization is very simple. It's the lowering of communication costs, transportation costs, the artificial barriers to goods and other factors of production, services, is referred to as globalization. It has led to a closer integration of the economies of the world and mobility, not only of goods and services, but of capital, knowledge, less so of people, and integration not only of these markets, but also of other issues like creation of a global civil society. The general thesis that I'm going to try to put forward today is that the most successful countries of the world have, in effect, partaken of globalization, have used globalization, but have done it on their own terms. The most successful countries in the world, the ones I referred to in East Asia, have had growth that has been based on exports that would not have been possible without globalization. But they have done that, as I said, very much in their own terms. For instance, they've involved gradual trade liberalization. They've involved no capital market liberalization for speculative capital flows, at least in the critical early years. many of the doctrines that were put forward were simply wrong and counterproductive. The IMF, for instance, said that one couldn't attract foreign direct investment unless one liberalized one's capital market, and liberalized the capital market to make opening up countries to short-term capital flows. That was wrong. The country that has been most successful in achieving foreign direct investment among the emerging markets, and probably by now the number two in the world as a whole, is China. And it has not opened up its capital markets. It has gradually been doing so, but it has done it at its own pace, and it has, as a result, has not suffered from the kinds of disasters that other countries in East Asia that liberalized under the influence of the IMF and the US Treasury has suffered. The benefits of globalization that have been experienced by East Asia have included not only access to markets, but also access to more knowledge. One of the things that we've emphasized that what separates developed and less developed countries is not only a shortage of capital, but a disparity in knowledge. And the closing of the knowledge gap has been one of the important aspects of globalization. There have been other positive aspects of globalization. For instance, the globalization of civil society that brought about the Landmines Treaty, and in the year 2000, the Jubilee Movement. The Jubilee Movement that succeeded in getting enormous amount of debt reduction for the highly indebted poor countries. Now, in the years that I was at the World Bank, there was a program for debt relief for the highly indebted poor countries, but the IMF had to pass on whether the countries met the basic standards. It makes sense that you didn't give money relief to countries that weren't doing a certain amount. They were just squandering the money. It didn't make sense, the view was, to have debt relief. But the bar was set so high that virtually almost no country could meet it. About three countries did it in 3 years. The result of the pressure that civil society placed in the Jubilee Movement was that in the year 2000, between 20 and 21 countries by the end of the year met that threshold. Now, it wasn't as if all of a sudden in the year 2000, countries around the world all of a sudden started behaving better. It was the recognition that the bar that had been set at the wrong level. And civil society put pressure to adjust, to put it in a more reasonable perspective, and it worked. In many parts of the world, though, globalization has not been run by the countries in ways which have enhanced their own welfare. The terms have been dictated by the outside. The result has been more poverty, more insecurity, more sense of voicelessness, weaker democracies, more volatility, weaker social fabric, and reflected in many cases by more violence. The reach of globalization has been enormous, and I constantly get impressed by this. I was in an Andean village in October, and had breakfast with the Indian mayor of the village, and the discussion turned to the views of what was going to happen to the euro, and whether. Not only was the discussion about the euro and whether it was what was going to happen to it, but they had already picked up all the vocabulary. Was it going to retrench? They were really up there and had picked up all the Financial Times jargon. That afternoon, I went to another village and met with the Indian mayor, and the discussion there was even more interesting. He started explaining to me how the neoliberal doctrines were undermining his village. And he explained how traditional Indian practices of democratic participation provided an alternative to the neoliberal doctrines. He also went on to describe in quite vivid terms how the WTO agreement had provided a framework under which biopiracy was occurring, that international firms were patenting, or American firms in particular, were patenting traditional medicines and making it difficult for people in the villages. I didn't have a chance to assess the accuracy of what he was charging, but what it did bring home very much is that the issue of globalization and the issue of what happens in Geneva is felt around the world, and that there is a real phenomenon of globalization, and it does affect people everywhere in the world. The objection, it also highlights the fact that really the objection is not to globalization. These Indian villages, some of their goods are being sold around the world, and their incomes are rising as a result. Their access to health is improved. Globalization has put pressure on countries to increase democracy. In many of these countries, 25 years ago, the Indians basically couldn't vote. It wasn't that they denied the Indians the vote. They had a very simple set of rules. It was you had to be literate to vote, and they made sure that they didn't have an education system to make them literate. So they had a self-perpetuating system in which basically the indigenous people did not have their democratic rights. And that's changed, and one of the sources of the force for change has been globalization. But the fact is that the objection is not to globalization as such, but to the way it has been managed. And in many cases, it has not been managed in ways that are in the interest of the developing countries. In a sense, what has happened over the last 50 years is that we've evolved a system of global governance without global government. I like to make an analogy to what happened in the United States and other Western countries 150 years ago, when there were similar processes of reducing transportation costs and communication costs, and which resulted in the formation of national economies with tremendous changes in economic forces. But when that occurred, there were national governments to manage that process and to make sure it worked well. In the United States, for instance, the first system of bank regulation, important to creating a strong national economy, was passed in 1863. Industrial policies in the form of support for agricultural sector, research and extension services, were also passed in the early 1860s. Even before that, government had played an important role in developing the telegraph lines, just as it did in the development of the internet. The first telegraph line was financed by the U.S. government between Baltimore and Washington in 1842. So there's a long history to this kind of strong involvement of government in trying to help shape the economy. But at the global scene, as we've been forming these global, as the process of globalization has occurred, we don't have a similar sort of democratic governance that can help shape and guide that process. The system of global governance has some very serious problems that I'm going to come to talk about in a few minutes. But the consequence of forming of this process of globalization is that there are a large number of phenomena that we can refer to as global externalities and global public goods. The most important examples of this have already gotten a great deal of attention. The pollution that occurs in one country can easily affect other countries. Global warming is the emission of greenhouse gases affects the atmosphere, and the high levels of greenhouse emissions in the United States and other developed countries affects all the countries of the world, including the less developed countries. Terrorism that occurs in one country can have effects on others. Diseases in one country can spread across boundaries. They don't know the nature of the political boundaries that exist. And so we have a wide variety of contexts in which it is important to undertake global collective action. But we don't have the political structures in which these can be undertaken in a democratic way. And the need for global collective action is particularly important in the context of development. The result of the absence of this has resulted in trade and other rules which are unfair. It has resulted in a system in which there is a great deal of hypocrisy, a great deal of asymmetries, in which policies tend to reflect more corporate and financial interests than the interest of the developing countries and the global economy more generally. Let me illustrate that by just a few examples. In terms of the issue of unfair rules, the last round of trade negotiations, the Uruguay round that was completed in 1994, was hailed as a great achievement. And it was for the United States and for most in Western Europe. We calculated the number of jobs that were calculated, what it would do to incomes. And it was a great thing. But at the World Bank, we also calculated the question of what was going to happen to sub-Saharan Africa. And the calculations were that it would be made, its income would be worse off by around 2% because of terms of trade effects. Basically, what was going on was the developed countries were insisting that the less developed countries open up their markets to their goods, but the developed countries maintained their trade barriers, their trade barriers against textiles, against agricultural goods. They maintained the subsidies on their agricultural goods, the goods which represented the comparative advantage of the developing world. So it was an agenda that was completely unfair. Take another issue. One of the great achievements was extending the area to services. But what were the areas of services that were of concern? The services that were put on the agenda were financial services, the comparative advantage of the United States and London and Paris, and IT, the comparative advantage, again, of the advanced industrial countries. Other kinds of services, like maritime services and construction services, were kept off the agenda. These were sectors that would be important to Korea and other developing countries. So it was an agenda that was set in a completely unfair way. The role of special interest was highlighted by the intellectual property agreement. Now, everybody recognizes the importance of intellectual property as an incentive to provide for intellectual endeavor. The United States Constitution, it's one of the things that the government is given the powers to do. But we also recognize that intellectual property law is not natural law. It's man-made, and it has to balance the users and the producers. Inside the White House, the Council of Economic Advisors and the Office of Science Technology Policy argued that the framework, the intellectual property framework that was being put forward by the U.S. Trade Representative in the negotiations in Geneva was unfair. It was an inappropriate framework. We were worried about a number of factors. One of the things that we were worried about was that with this intellectual property framework, poor developing countries would not have access to drugs that were life-saving, and as a result of that, people would die. Signing that agreement was, in effect, potentially a death warrant. And we said that that didn't seem to be appropriate. It didn't reflect at least the values of a lot of us. We also said that the most important input to research is knowledge. An unbalanced intellectual property regime could lead to an increase in the cost of the input to research, and therefore could actually slow down the pace of intellectual innovation. And that's one of the reasons why the Office of Science and Technology Policy was against the rules that were being set up. But the provisions that were adopted in Geneva as part of the Uruguay round did not reflect the views of either the Office of Science Technology Policy or the Council of Economic Advisors. They reflected the views of the pharmaceutical and drug companies and the other people, the corporate interests, who wanted to see stronger intellectual property, because their view was the stronger, the better. balance was not something that they knew. That's one example. Let me give you an example on the area another example. Capital market liberalization has been pushed both by the U.S. Treasury and by the IMF. In early 93, the issue came up, we were engaged in a set of negotiations with Korea. There were all kinds of issues at dispute. These trade negotiations, if you haven't been under them, are really very peculiar because all kinds of commodities come up. One of the issues was Korea discriminating against Iowa sausages? You know, an issue I never thought I would come to Washington and have to think about sausages. But of much more substance was the issue on capital market liberalization. Korea had plans to liberalize its capital and financial markets. But from the point of view of the U.S. Treasury, the view was that it was done too slowly. We had, the Council of Economic Advisors wrote a couple papers. One of them said, we ought to think about prioritization. We ought to think about what are the things that are most important to the United States. Is sausage more important than, some other commodity? We used to tease the Bush administration that one of its great achievements in the negotiations with Japan was that it succeeded in getting in Toys R Us into Japan, which allowed China to sell cheaper goods to Japanese children, which improved the welfare of Chinese workers and Japanese children. But we weren't quite sure what America was getting out of this and why it should be so high on our agenda. And the issue here was we ought to have a framework for thinking about prioritization. The view that Larry Summers and the U.S. Treasury took is that prioritization confused things. And the reason was quite obvious, because it wasn't clear that Americans as a whole would think opening up markets around the world to destabilizing derivatives was something that was high on the agenda of American, should be high on the agenda of American economic policy. But Treasury did. Because it represented opportunities for profits. And it was particularly important that this be done quickly, because who knows, if you waited 4 or 5 years, Japanese firms, European firms, or even Korean firms might be able to compete effectively. But if we did it quickly, American firms would get a beachhead in. So speed was of the essence. And that brought us to our second issue. We said the evidence was overwhelming that capital market liberalization done rapidly would lead to economic instability. Well, in areas of financial markets, Treasury trumps the Council of Economic Advisors. And that was their area of expertise. And Treasury won, and the global economy lost. Just as we had predicted, there was a crisis in Korea 3 years after the policy. Treasury says, well, it wasn't done right. Our view was the likelihood of doing it right when it's done rapidly is very low. And we were right. The issue of hypocrisy is similar. Shortly after he took over the position of Secretary of Treasury, Paul O'Neill gave a often quoted speech, and he said, the problem with the world is not that there's too much competition, but there's too little. Not that there's too much capitalism, but there's too little. Not long after that, he proposed setting up a global steel cartel. And he cited as evidence for this, the success he had had when he was chairman of the board of Alcoa of setting up a global aluminum cartel. And this is called capitalism American style. There are also the asymmetries, and these are very important, particularly I emphasize in a place like LSE. The United States is going through a recession. It's in a recession. I happen to think it's being very badly managed, but that's not the point. That's another topic which I could go into. And this is not politics, this is just fact. But everybody agrees on one thing, that it's important to have a stimulus package. You should understand what a stimulus package is. You know, you spend more money to stimulate the economy, that increases income. It happens to be that the U.S. administration thinks that it's a good idea, to give you a picture of their view of stimulus, I can't resist, is they're having tax cuts in which the average poor American making $50,000 a year will get, over 4 years, zero. But the average American that you may know that makes a mere $5 million a year, suffering to get by as the prices of Porsches go up and the other problems that they face, will get, over 4 years, $500,000. And this is supposed to stimulate the American economy. Well, anyway, the point I wanted to make is that everybody agrees, at least with the rhetoric, that it's important to have countercyclical fiscal policy. Keynesian economics is alive and well everywhere among the developed countries. But you go into a developing country, and they are told when they face an economic downturn, you have to cut your expenditures. Don't look at the structural deficit, which is what we tell our students they ought to be looking at. That means what the deficit would be if you were at full employment. Look at your actual deficit. Don't use good accounting, which includes taking good appropriate account of capital asset investments and movements from one reserve account to another. Just do it on naive, bad accounting principles. And if on those basis you're showing a deficit, cut your expenditures, with a predictable consequence that you go into a deeper downturn. This is the wonderful medicine that was prescribed for Argentina. It had a deficit, it told it, cut expenditures. What happened? GDP went down further. They began from a strong base of only 15% unemployment. And under the IMF policies they got up, they were approaching 20% open unemployment, but another 10%. 15% disguised unemployment, 30-35% all told. The wonder of Argentina is not that riots broke out, but that it took so long. They've had double-digit unemployment since 1995. They've had a worsening recession since 1997. And as I say, as I kept going back, I couldn't understand why it didn't break out earlier. But the question I get over and over again is, Why is it that in the North you are allowed to do, you believe in countercyclical policies, in the South we're not allowed to do that? Even if we have the resources to finance it. And that's really quite remarkable, because there are countries that have resources coming on, not now, but they could borrow against those future resources, and they're not allowed to do that. The same general principle holds in the area of a whole variety of economic policies. In the North, we are engaged in active debates about the nature of the reform of pension programs, the role of the government, and the role of the private sector. In the United States, we have been looking at the data for Britain, and we see the magnitude of the transaction cost, that they are eating up about 40% of your of the benefits on the privatized part, by some estimates, are lowered by 40% as a result of the transaction cost. And some of us have found that not exactly a good way of providing protection for our old age. The fall of the stock market has also led to a view that privatization of the Social Security is not the right view. And yet, the international institutions have, to a large extent, but not universally, been pushing privatization around the world. The view is not, the point I want to make here is that these are difficult issues on which reasonable people could differ, but it's important that there be a lively democratic debate about the course of action. And too frequently, countries feel that they are not given that choice. I referred earlier to the issue of capital market liberalization. One of the arguments of capital market liberalization is that the free flow of capital will improve economic efficiency and promote economic growth. As I said before, what was remarkable was that this view was pushed, even though there was very little evidence that it would increase economic growth and a considerable body of evidence that it would promote economic instability. But another argument is put forward, and I want to raise this argument because it's so heard so commonly and it is so misguided, and that is capital markets provide important discipline. And they do provide some discipline. But if you're going to choose a disciplinarian, and you don't believe in democracy, I mean, democracy is supposed to be a part of the discipline device. Governments that don't perform well should be thrown out in the elections. And normally we think that that democratic processes are the key part of the check. But if you don't trust democracy, think very carefully about your choice of disciplinarian. I happen not to like disciplinarians, but if you do, you want a disciplinarian that is not capricious and gives you the right discipline. The nature of capital markets is that they're both capricious and they often push wrong policies. Capriciousness is evidenced by the volatility that marks capital markets. We saw that most dramatically in East Asia when a few weeks before the crisis in Thailand, Thai bonds were selling for 85 basis points over LIBOR. And a few weeks later, the risk premiums had jumped to hundreds of basis points. The market had suddenly changed its views. Shiller has described the excess volatility and documented the excess volatility that characterizes the capital markets. In fact, the work of others has shown that most of the disturbances that countries face are not caused by their own failures, but are brought from external disturbances, many of them via the capital markets. Moreover, as I said, capital markets are a peculiar form of disciplinarian because they have a particular view of what is good economics. The way I like to bring this home is to think of what would happen if you had another kind of disciplinarian. Think of what would happen rather than having the free flow of capital, you had a free flow of, say, skilled labor. And that free flow of skilled labor said, unless you provide the kind of environment that we like, we'll leave. And of course, if you lost overnight all your skilled labor, any economy would be in deep trouble. So think just that thought experiment of what would happen if you really had free flow of skilled labor. They might worry about the nature of the environment, whether you had clean air, with the quality of the education in the public schools. It would be a very different kind of discipline than is provided by the discipline of the free market. Moreover, the free market charges an enormous amount for the provision of these services. Think for a moment about the standard wisdom today concerning prudential behavior on the part of governments when facing international capital markets. In a poor country, if a firm were to borrow $100 million from an American bank, it would have to pay, say, something like 18-20% interest. The dictates of prudential policy is that countries need to keep in reserves an amount at least equal to the amount of foreign-denominated outstanding short-term loans. So what does that mean? The country has to set aside $100 million in reserves. How do most countries keep those reserves? Most countries keep those reserves in U.S. bond, treasury bills. Now what does that mean to that country? It means that in effect, from the perspective of this poor country, it is borrowing from the United States and paying 20%, but lending to the United States, when you buy a U.S. treasury bill, you're lending to the United States, lending to the United States at 2%. In effect, this poor country is giving foreign aid to the United States of $18 million a year. Now, you can understand why the United States might like this. And you can understand why this might be good for growth in the United States. But it is very hard to see why this would be good for growth in the poor country. And this is what is going on. And I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. Well, I have a proclivity for talking too long. As I said, the topic is long, and I'm just scratching the bottom. I'm just scratching a little bit of these issues. I think it's from having suffered so long at the White House and the World Bank, where I was only allowed to talk for brief amounts of time, and I've decided to try to make up by giving 2 or 3 hour lectures. But I've been told that you want to have a question period. So let me go to my agenda for reform. Is that okay? And skip some of the more specifics, the problems I have with foreign direct investment, international banking, money laundering, and some other minor topics. And if you're kind, you'll maybe ask questions about them in the question period. Okay, let me just raise 7 points on reform. The fundamental problem, there have been enormous failures as I look about the process of globalization. I tried to describe the picture broadly, but I could have gone in more detail. If you look, the crises, there have been more crises in the last quarter century than ever before. They've been deeper. There have been about close to 100 countries that have had a crisis in the last a little more than a quarter century. They've not been well managed. A lot of innocent people have had to suffer. The policies, if I had more time to explain, why it is that the policies that were pushed by the IMF actually made things worse rather than better, it has been, in crisis management, a failure. But compared to the management of the transition from communism to a market economy, there things are even worse. GDP in Russia today is a third below what it was at the beginning of the transition. Poverty rates have gone from about 2% to somewhere between 20 and 40%, depending on how you measure it. In 1998, one study of the World Bank said that 1 out of 2 children were living in families in poverty. An enormous increase. Everybody thought that the communist economic system was so flawed, central planning, no private property, therefore no incentives, rife with distortions, moving to a market economy that would have decentralization, get rid of central planning, provide privatization that would provide incentives, liberalize that would get rid of the distortions, ought to move you towards the production possibility curve, to use a technical jargon, ought to increase income. Getting rid of the huge expenditures on defense ought to raise standards of living even more. In the longer term, as you restructure the structure investment, income should increase even more. A decade after the beginning of the transition, that is not as what happened. Things are far worse. Some countries have made it even worse. Moldavia income is down 2/3 from what it was. The transition, and the contrast between that transition and the transition in China is very marked. In the case of China, incomes are up in the last decade 250%, and poverty is down. At the beginning of the decade, China's income was roughly somewhat like 60% of Russia's. At the end of the decade, Russia's is 60% of China's. It's just an enormous turnaround. And in development, as I described before, the successes, there have been successes, but most of those successes have not been in countries that have had adopted the neoliberal doctrines. They were countries that have adopted their own policies. The failures have been very marked. So there is a great deal of dissatisfaction. There have been these failures, and I describe the unfairness, the hypocrisy, the asymmetries that underlie many of these many of these problems. And that leads to a concern about why have there been these failures, what can be done to mitigate them. The first item in the agenda, and the most important, is changing governance. The people making these decisions have been bright people. But as economists and as political scientists, we recognize that the decision-making structure affects the kinds of decisions that get made. And in the international institutions, there are a number of fundamental problems. The first fundamental problem is that of representation. Within our own economies, when we come to making economic decisions, we bring together all the relevant parties in a cabinet meeting or a sub-cabinet meeting, and something in the United States we call it the National Economic Council. It brings together people from commerce, from trade, from the Council of Economic Advisors, from justice, because we're concerned about antitrust policy, from treasury, from large numbers of parts of the government. And we argue. We include the people from the environment. We argue about various policies, and all the stakeholders indirectly have voices. In the international arena, we have a system of what might be described as silos. The WTO, the negotiations are done by the trade ministers. The environmental ministers are not in the room when the discussions go on. The labor ministers are not in the room when the discussions go on. And there's very little discussion. I described in the intellectual property discussions how the Council of Economic Advisors and the Office of Science and Technology Policy, people who had expertise in the issue of patent law, wanted to have a say, but they were excluded. This is the realm of the decision-making of the trade minister. The same thing's true with the IMF. I sometimes jokingly say there's a broad spectrum of opinions, all the way from finance ministers to central bank governors. And one of the agenda items of the IMF to increase its democratic accountability, so-called, is to make sure that the people who really have the voice, which are the central bank governors, are made independent and therefore not democratically accountable. So it is not accountable to a group that is not accountable. It's a wonderful system, and to have that as one of your main policy agenda. And it's self-affirming, because as you do that, you all say, isn't it wonderful the way we are running the world? And they all then talk together, and they feel very good about themselves and go on. As they went about discussing the problems with the international economic architecture, guess who got invited to the table to redesign the table? The same people who were at the table. All these other people would just confuse the discussions. And you know, why would you want to have labor ministers there talking about these policies, even though they affect unemployment rates? It isn't as if what's at issue is payment clearance mechanisms between two different banks. If that was at issue, then you could say, let the technical people decide it. But what is at issue in these international economic organizations are the rules of the game that affect every aspect of society. And yet the way the voting gets done is this very, very narrow way. The second related issue has to do with voting. Who gets the vote? Within our own democracies, we recognize that one person, one vote. Even on economic matters, I think it was in the reforms of 1835 that you eliminated here the property qualifications for voting. I'm not quite sure. Somebody here must know those dates. But in any case, in the IMF and the World Bank, votes are allocated on the basis of some measure of economic wealth. But it's not even today's economic wealth. It's largely economic wealth as of the end of World War II. And since then, there has been enormous change in the global economy. So it is not a surprise that with this distorted representation, you get distorted outcomes. In the IMF, in the UN, we often complain that five countries determined historically have the veto power. The world's second largest country by population, India, does not have the veto power. France does. Now, I don't want to offend anybody from France here, and France is a very important country, but... But the fact of the matter is that the allocation of veto rights, it's hard to figure out what democratic principle that accords to. At the IMF, one country and one country alone has the veto power. It's called the G1. And it's not shy about using that. Well, let me say, I don't think that one country is going to give up its veto very easily. And while I want to encourage the UK and France and other countries to put pressure, and Japan and all the other countries to put pressure, and peer pressure is important, and this is a long-run reform. Unless these reforms occur, I think we will continue to see the kinds of problems that we've seen. But there are other intermediate reforms that I think can make and will make a very big difference. The first of these is openness. In a way, this is related to the work that I've really spent a lot of my life devoted to. I've been concerned a lot of my life, professional life, with the issue of the economics of information, the importance that information has in economic processes. But one of the things that I became increasingly clear as I was at the White House and the World Bank is the importance of information in political processes. And the more remote the political processes are from direct accountability of democratic processes, the more important, I would argue, are those access to information. Within our democracies, within the United States, we have adopted a principle of the right to know. We have a Freedom of Information Act, and almost daily you can read something in the press, and today I saw something in the British press, where key pieces of information were obtained by the press through the Information Act. This is a very different perspective than one that has prevailed in Britain, where when I did a little consulting a number of years ago, I was forced to sign an Official Secrets Act, something I felt guilty about for a long time, and decided therefore to preach for my sin and tell everybody they ought to go more for the Freedom of Information Act and the Right to Know laws. I think these are absolutely essential. And yet within an international framework, there is no Freedom of Information Act. If an American citizen wants to find out about what is going on in the IMF, even of his representative, it's often very difficult. There is one episode that epitomizes how badly things have gone. The U.S. Congress passed a particular provision instructing the executive directors, the representative of the American government, at the IMF and the World Bank to vote a particular way on a particular set of issues. And the American executive director did not follow those directions. But it was secret, so Congress could not know. And it was only because of the wonderful fact that these international institutions leak all the time, and that in fact, while they try to keep secrets, they don't do a very effective job, that Congress found out that the U.S. representative had voted in violation of the congressional mandate. But this helps illustrate the difficulty of the difficulties. Part of this issue of better information, I want to emphasize, is better accounting frameworks, and that's a whole technical subject, but I wanted to highlight that because it is something of which I'm greatly concerned. The third element in my agenda for reform entails narrowing the remit of the IMF. The IMF, like many other organizations, has broadened its mandate from focusing on crises to involved in transitions, to involved in development. And it has, in doing that, not done a very good job in those other areas. Within its original mandate, it was set up under the intellectual influence of Keynes to encourage countries facing an economic downturn to have expansionary policies and to provide the liquidity with which they can finance those expansionary policies. One of the very interesting stories is that if you look at the first examples of conditionality, first examples where a country had trouble getting access to IMF funds, to World Bank funds, it was because the country was pursuing an excessively contractionary monetary policy. Yet today, in country after country, the IMF insists as a condition of providing funds that the country maintain a contractionary fiscal policy, just the opposite of what Keynes had in mind when he founded it. As I say, narrowing the remit of the IMF won't solve the problem because, in fact, it did not do a very good job in the East Asia crisis and the other crises. There has to be a change in the approach to these crises. And that's a very broad topic, a subject of its own right. But there has been one sign of progress, an enormous sign of progress recently, but one which will need enormous amount of pressure to push forward. The policy of big bailouts is being replaced, or at least it's being discussed to be replaced, by a policy of focusing on bankruptcies and standstills. This was the position that I argued 5 years ago at the beginning of the East Asia crisis. At the time, those within the IMF said bankruptcy amounted to tearing up, to a reneging on a debt contract. I tried to explain that bankruptcy was actually part of an unwritten provision of any debt contract, that countries like Britain had given up debtor prisons a long time ago, and that I assume that most other people still didn't believe in debtor prisons, even if the IMF might. In the 19th century, when Mexico failed to pay its debt obligations, the British and the French armies moved in. And today we don't quite believe that when countries don't pay their debts, you ought to use armies. But you try to use economic coercion as the view. And I think most of us believe in bankruptcy, giving fresh start, starting over again, is an important part of the appropriate approach. One of the reasons why more extensive debt forgiveness in the form of HIPC is so important. The point was that in order to preserve the credit contract, the IMF all too often shredded the social contract. It said it was okay to throw thousands of millions of people into unemployment, cut back food subsidies, cut back, eliminate kerosene subsidies, and the consequences were predicted and predictable. The kinds of riots that broke out in Indonesia. It was not just bad social policy, it was bad economic policy, because with those riots, those countries were devastated and the economies have yet to recover. The fifth part of the agenda, or a fifth element of the agenda, is broader surveillance. One of the things that the IMF does today is to go into a country and say, we experts on economic management think that you ought to change the way you are managing your economic policy in such and such a way. Exposed to provide peer pressure. It originated as what was called Article 4 consultations, a consultation to make sure that the country was complying with the Articles of Agreement of the IMF. But as expansion mission creep occurs in every area, it expanded from that, which is now just a paragraph in the so-called Article 4 consultation, to a very broad-based surveillance that includes many aspects of the macroeconomic activity. I saw that kind of surveillance in the case of the United States. They come not only to developing countries, but the United States as well, the UK. We looked at the report. Fortunately, we didn't have to pay any attention to it. Fortunately, capital markets do not pay any attention to it when it comes to the United States. I'm told that if I say what we actually did, which is throw it in the garbage can, it would be too phlegmatic, and I shouldn't say things like that. So I'm not going to say that. But the fact is, we didn't pay any attention to it. What did they recommend? What did they say? They said inflation was about to break out in the United States. Why? Because they said that if unemployment ever got below 6.2%, inflation broke out. We had done a careful study of that. We had analyzed what were the forces, technically for those of you economists, what were the forces that affect the NARA, the natural, the level of unemployment below which inflation starts to increase. And we, on the basis of our analysis, had concluded that the NARA was substantially lower than the 6.2% that it had been a decade earlier. They hadn't done that kind of careful analysis. And therefore, they said that if that unemployment gets below 6%, 6.2%, you're going to get inflation. We were right, they were wrong. Unemployment got down to 3.9%, and we still had no inflation. They're having changes in the structure of our economy and the global economy that meant, that allowed us to do this. But what was equally important was the implication from a policy point of view was to increase interest rates. If we had increased interest rates, the great expansion of the 1990s would have been stifled. But what was important here was the IMF not only had its economics wrong, it also focused too narrowly on a single objective, inflation. We were concerned about other things. We knew our concern was with unemployment, but not just because we were concerned about unemployment. We recognized that the most important aspect of our social policy was getting the unemployment rate down. That if we got our unemployment rate down, our welfare rolls would get down. We predicted, and we were right, that if we got our unemployment rate down and our welfare rolls down, the violence rate, the criminal rate, would go down. And again, we were right. So this macroeconomic policy is part of social policy, and the most important element of our social policy. And yet these were concerns that never even entered into the minds of the people doing the Article 4 consultation from the IMF, or at least it didn't seem to be the case in what they reported. It seems to me that it's important to broaden the range of surveillance to include the kinds of concerns, for instance, the ILO today talks about, of decent work, employment policy, a whole host of other things, a whole host of other expertise of people who look at the economy from different perspectives and sometimes with different values. I'm not arguing for an exclusion, elimination of the IMF report, only to say that it's one piece of information among several that ought to go into the economic decision-making framework of countries. The sixth thing I want to emphasize is that we need to focus more on strengthening democracies. That many of the policies that have been pursued and the ways that particularly the IMF but other institutions have operated has undermined democracy by narrowing the set of options, by imposing conditionality. Returning to the theme that I emphasized earlier, the problem is not with globalization, but with it has, how it is managed. Finally, I want to conclude by talking about global public goods and externalities. As I said, one of the important aspects of globalization is the recognition that there are of the great growing importance of global public goods and externalities. There are many of these. I've mentioned several of these already. One recognizes today that if you have places where money laundering can occur, Cayman Islands, it affects other countries because illegal activity in these other countries gets laundered through what goes on in the Cayman Islands. For those of you who don't know, you know, the Cayman Islands, there's a lot of these offshore secret banking accounts where illegal activities, money can be basically laundered. About $500 billion go through, I think, the Cayman Islands alone. It's not because the Cayman Islands knows how to do banking better than Wall Street or better than London. It's simply that they are protected from the scrutiny that would occur It allows them to undertake illegal to launder illegal money. The OECD recognized the nature of the public good nature of this issue, and a year ago drafted a treaty that was meant to reduce the opportunities for this kind of activity to occur. Yeah. The US vetoed it. After September 11th, it was recognized that those same centers were also the centers through which the terrorists were funded, recognizing that another aspect of globalization. But it's important for development in the context of this talk, because from countries like Africa, there is enormous amount of illegal activity where money is fleeing from Africa. Money is going out of Africa. And what allows this to occur to a large extent are these offshore banking centers where people can steal from their country and not be prosecuted. And this is an issue not only of terrorism, not only of drugs and money laundering, but it's an issue of development. We need to have ways of financing these global public goods. And there are a variety of ways of doing that, and I have another little talk to give on that subject, but I've been told I have minus about 10 minutes. Minus 5 minutes. Okay. So, but it's still in the negative. But let me just mention two. One is a framework that's already been decided upon. SDRs, special drawing rights, the emissions of additional liquidity, to offset the liquidity that is the money that is being put into reserves every year. That what I talked about before in the context of the poor developing country. If those SDR emissions occurred every year and were used to finance global public goods, in particular development, it could provide a source of funding which would be not dependent on the vagaries of the national parliaments of particular countries. And the second source of funding that I think is important, possible, is the recognition that there are a large amount of global commons, global natural resources. Minerals under the sea, minerals in the sea, fish in the sea, Antarctica, and probably most important, our atmosphere. If the revenues generated from the management of these global resources were used to help finance global public goods, we would have another assured base to help finance the global public goods and address the global externalities that will be of increasing importance as we approach the problems of globalization. In short, the agenda of globalization and development is a broad one. I don't think there's any issue of greater importance. I think globalization does have enormous potential for promoting economic development. I think, however, the way globalization has proceeded over the last 50 years, it has not lived up to that potential. There are reforms, some difficult, but others that are clearly feasible, and that I think it's important as we enter into this new century that we try to undertake in a serious way the reform of the globalization process to make sure that it is able to live up closer to its potential and to improve the lives and livelihoods of those in the developing world. Thank you.
Well, before he gave that bravura performance, I asked Professor Stiglitz if he'd take questions. He said he would, but only if they're good questions. So, do you want to chair your own? Do you want to pick your own questions?
Okay. Oh, no, why don't you call on people? You know what biases they have.
Yeah, there are roving mics around the room.
Thanks. Well, the questions could go on for at least the same amount of time as the talk. But I have a very brief question, which is this. What do you think the chances are that there will be, perhaps when Mr. Wolfenson resigns, a change in the rules for selecting the heads of these international organizations? The IMF and the World Bank have been the preserve of the Europeans in the IMF case, the World Bank in the case of the US. But with this last appointment of the managing director of the IMF, there was a chance that that rule might be broken for the first time, where the Africans nominated a candidate, the Japanese nominated a candidate.
Sorry about that. Carry on.
Well, anyway,
I got the point. Okay. Okay.
The point is that last time when the managing director of the IMF...
No, I think we got the point. Thanks. Yeah. Everyone got the point. I think we need to allow Professor Stiglitz to answer.
Okay. Right. Okay. Yeah, I think there is a considerable chance. For those of you who don't know, there has been this long tradition that the IMF is always a European, the World Bank always an American. He doesn't have to be American-born, but he has to change his citizenship before, and so that he is officially classified as an American. And it's a wonderful job because you don't even have to get congressional approval. So most other appointees of the president have to be approved by the U.S. Congress. This is the U.S. Senate. This does not even require any congressional approval. I think what is remarkable about this appointments process is not only that it violates every principle that we normally talk about. You normally talk about an open and transparent process. It's not that. You usually say we want somebody who has expertise. Well, where has the IMF business been for the last, I think, 26 years? The last country who was not a less developed country to get money was Britain. and that was the last, that's been 26 years, I think, since you. The idea that the person who would be appointed as the head of IMF would actually know something about a developing country was not even included in the job description. And that they might actually have lived in a developing country was beyond even thinking about. It seems to me that as we move to a more globalized world and we recognize that there are people who are well-educated, who know something about the world, who don't happen to be born in either America or Europe, I think the broadening out is almost inevitable. The WTO, for the first time, I think, is it just taken office or is about to, what? In August, will be headed by somebody not from Europe, not from the United States. And this is the first movement in really the globalization of the international economic institutions.
There's a question from up the back there.
Yes, with due respect, I'd just like to suggest that there is an asymmetry between your analysis, which I found very radical and challenged issues of economic power, and your reforms, which only dealt with questions of governance and decision making. And I don't feel that you established sufficiently the connection between the two. How do you think your reforms will actually challenge the economic power, the uneven economic power that exists?
Oh, you want to gather some questions and answer them all? Yeah.
I think we'll just do them one by one.
The one by one, okay.
Unless you want time to reflect.
No. Let me just say, I don't think any of these reforms are a panacea. The real question is, how can we move things in the right direction? I think that if you think about some of the key issues concerning the balance of workers and financial and corporate interests within our own democracies within the United States, we have some check. I don't want to, you know, Enron. Corporate interests do have an important role, but at the same time, they are checked. They are constantly checked, and there's a scrutiny provided by the press. that is an important part of that process. So my own view is that these kinds of reforms, while they're not a panacea, will significantly change the balance in ways that will work more broadly in the interest of developing countries and in the interest of labor and environment within developing countries. There's a meeting in Monterrey, Mexico in March on finance and development. It is not getting off to a good start. There were originally in the previous draft of the protocol, as those of you who know how these meetings proceed, very little gets decided in the meetings. All the things go on in the preparation for the meetings, and these are long discussions. The previous draft recognized that financing for development entailed many dimensions. For instance, it talked about trade, the importance of trade as generating income that was important for financing development. It talked about debt relief. It talked about more aid, commitment to the 0.7% of income in the more developed countries. It talked about financing global. It talked about financing global public goods. And I was hopeful that, and I still am hopeful, that in the informal discussion, some of the proposals that I had talked about, the SDR proposal, the Global Commons. And there was even some discussion of taxes like Tobin tax or carbon tax be added to the agenda. The United States, from what I've heard, both in some reports that appeared in the Financial Times, but also heard from people who were at the meeting that just ended, has taken a very hard line and said if the word global public goods is mentioned, they won't participate. That if the 0.7% number is used, they won't participate. And they've taken a very, very hard line. And a view in many circles is that as a result, it will be a very people are not sanguine about anything serious coming out of that discussion. Things are not over. These processes continue to go on, and until the actual conference occurs, one can't predict what will happen. In my suggestions for what they ought to have done, I included many of the things that I've already talked about, reform of the, including bankruptcy, discussion of bankruptcy, discussion of money laundering, those reforms, because the vehicle that it does for draining money out of countries, which is as important as trying to get money into a country.
Question from down here. No, I thought it was.
Well, I think it's a wonderful reform program. The question is, how do we get there? I just wanted to ask you two things. One, you mentioned the dominance of G1. So how do you change the role of the United States? Because isn't that central? And the second, you mentioned global civil society. That looked very positive on September the 10th. We could see after Genoa a lot of responsiveness from the international institutions. Since September the 11th, the role of global civil society seems to have been very much marginalized in these debates. And so where is the space for change?
Well, I don't want to sound Pollyannish, but I do remain optimistic on two grounds. First, I think that the setback of September 11th is only temporary. The issues are too important, and global civil society is too resilient for this really to be more than a temporary setback. So my own mind, I think that they will be back on the agenda. It may be a more muted form. I mean, they may not be marching with quite the vehemence that occurred in Genoa, but I'm not sure that was that important anyway. I think that there are other ways. Jubilee 2000 had its influence mainly by a whole variety of other mechanisms, not just the protest marches. So I am optimistic. I'm also optimistic that the current administration, which is based on a very strong unilateralist view, will be removed from office in not too distant future. So, so on the basis of those two elements of optimism, I think that we need to continue discussing, debating the issues, trying to crystallize what kinds of reforms we would want to put in place when the opportunity arises. There are issues on this reform agenda that have already begun to be adopted and discussed. I talked about the bankruptcy. I think after, 5 years, I pushed that agenda. It wasn't until the final collapse of the umpteenth bailout in the case of Argentina that people finally said, well, it looks like, we gave a nice gift to Stan Fisher, but we don't want to continue giving these kinds of gifts. And we really need an alternative framework. It may be that they aren't convinced this is the right alternative framework, but they can't think of anything else, so that they're willing to begin to talk about this. So I think that the deficiencies are sufficiently great. Let me give you one more example that happened after September 11th. The agenda that was set at Doha included many elements that I think were hard to conceive of 4 years ago. Certainly at the end of the Uruguay round, there was a lot of pessimism. Admittedly, a lot of these issues are what was agreed on Doha, that is that they were beginning to discuss certain issues, not the conclusion of those discussions. But the United States refused until then, but to even willing to discuss reform of the anti-dumping laws. It refused to move on the issues of intellectual property. So the fact that there has been, I think, near global recognition of the unfair nature of the Uruguay round and the previous trade negotiations, it's very hard to find anybody that today will defend that, those Uruguay. I think that's a major intellectual victory, and I think that makes it a very different framework for policies to go on. And you can see it, I mean, I see Nick here, you can see that in the kind of things coming out of the World Bank today that really very much reflect some of these changes.
I think we've got time for at least a couple more questions. David, you wanted to ask one, didn't you? Okay, there's someone up the top there.
Yeah, I'll follow on the question the other woman asked. It's on the one hand, you criticize the policy of the US and of the international financial institutions. And on the other hand, you were in charge. I mean, you worked for the US government and you worked for the World Bank. So that seems to me like a slight contradiction. So what did you actually do in order to initiate the changes you indicated?
Well, let me say, I work for these institutions. I unfortunately didn't run them. A lot of people say it was fortunate that I didn't run them. But the nature of democracy is that no one really runs anything. And you have to, even the president doesn't run the U.S. government. The reason why there's these subjects called political science is that the process of decision making are very complicated. And what one does when one is in the government is try to promote certain ideas, get them on the agenda, change the nature of the debate, change the nature of the arguments. And it's a very slow process. But I can also say that it is a process which in which you can see some changes occur. And I don't even really, I jokingly say I wish they would do everything I wanted, but I also recognize that there are people who disagree with me, a few. And I recognize that if they were running things, I would be very unhappy. And so the nature of democratic processes is that you try to come to an understanding of these different views. And I I've been a very strong advocate of trying to make the processes more democratic, more open, so that more voices get heard. And my concern has been that, to a large extent, there hasn't been as wide a discussion of a lot of the key issues as there could be. And I think that there have been changes in the right direction, even in those areas.
Question down the front here. Can you speak really loudly so the people upstairs?
About the reform process required at the international level. I would like to know your opinion on the priorities at the national level for a developing country to take advantage of the positive aspects of globalization while sheltering itself from the mismanagement that you talked about. In other words, that it can follow the example perhaps of a Korea rather than going down the route of a Russia. And obviously this is a huge topic, but in your view, what are perhaps the two or three key requirements?
It is a huge topic, and one of the reasons it's such a huge topic is that I would argue that what is appropriate for one country can be markedly different from what is appropriate for another country. And one of the complaints of the neoliberal doctrines is that they have been insufficiently contextualized, insufficiently adapted to the circumstances of the different countries. One of the reasons why, say, the policy of high interest rates were such a disaster in East Asia, when it was not such a disaster in Latin America, was that the East Asian firms were very highly indebted and had a lot of short-term debt. When you have that high level of indebtedness and you raise interest rates, you force them into bankruptcy. When you then lower the interest rate, you don't unbankrupt them. And that simple principle was not well understood. The kind of, you know, the kinds of reform programs that I think one needs a multifaceted reform program. A lot of it has to do, that's emphasized increasingly, has to do with the functioning of public institutions. Better governance within the country, less corruption. You know, there are a whole set of agenda along those lines. Another set of agenda has to do with infrastructure. If you don't have ports, you can't actively participate. Another part is education. If you don't have educated people, you can't adopt the new technologies. To give you just one example of another country that is trying to think about what it's doing on a little bit on its own terms, is Costa Rica. And just to mention a couple elements of its policies. One of the things that it did is it wanted to attract Intel, very large factory, $400 or $500 million investment. It's become the second largest export of the country. And one of the things that it spent a lot of time talking to Intel, what were the things Intel needed that would attract it? One of the things that Intel said was that it was important that it be able to have its imports go through customs within an hour, so that if a part breaks, it can call up the United States, put it in the FedEx, and be down in the factory and down to Costa Rica and in the factory by the morning. And Costa Rica said, we can do that. And it did it. Well, that shows a certain level of competence in the public authorities. There are other public authorities in Nigeria, there are cases where goods remain in the port for 6 months. And that really is a big impediment. Not that I want to promote English, but another part of their program is that everybody in the country needs to be both computer illiterate and literate in English. And they've said that they want, you know, that will be very important in their ability to interact in the global economy. So just a couple examples of the kinds of strategies that some countries are doing that I think are more focused on strengthening their economy and their societies.
I've got time for one last question, I think. Maybe there's some defiant neoliberal lurking in the audience somewhere.
Oh, yeah, here he is, down the front.
Question. I think you should dump the word democracy when talking about global governance. I mean, in a world of 190 states where there's a difference between China and the United States, the populations therein, and Costa Rica or Seychelles or whatever, it doesn't make much sense. Everybody knows the limitations of the UN General Assembly in that respect. Surely legitimate, and as for global civil society, with the best will in the world, that I don't see that somehow as constituting itself in spontaneously into the general will, even if one defines it in terms of the demonstrations on the streets of Genoa. Surely the better term is legitimacy here, because we're talking about decisions which are going to be taken by elites whether you like it or not. It's a question of which elites and how far they're understood and how far they're accepted, and so that they can therefore be implemented with a degree of follow through. So maybe the points you were making about information, education, and indeed one could add the whole dimension of parliamentary scrutiny through various intergovernmental assemblies and levels of participation is perhaps a bit more relevant than the notion of actual democracy.
Well, I agree with most of what you said, that what one of the things that is important is this broader notion of legitimacy. I was using the word maybe democracy too loosely, and I think what you're talking about is correct. At the same time, I think there is a broader sense of participation than the use of the term elites that you used would reflect. That in the, to give you several of the programs at the World Bank have involved broad participation and broader ownership. And there's some evidence that projects with broader participation at the local level are more successful. There are a whole variety of ways in which societies can achieve broader participation that go well beyond the elites. There are countries where they've had very large national dialogues that have reached into every part of the world, every part of the country, and that have involved large numbers of people, not just the elites. So I am more optimistic that this debate can be broadened out beyond. I don't want to, you know, pretend that even the vocabulary of global governance is going to be reaching down into the everywhere in the world. But the story I gave about what was going on in the Andean villages shows that some of these issues are being discussed beyond the elites, or at least beyond traditional elites. And that one of the things that's at stake is the creation, in part, of new elites, or broadening the people who participate actively in these decision-making processes. And I think there it can be a genuine broadening out of these discussions.
Thank you. Could I just mention that the next lecture in this series will be Professor Robert Wade, who asked the first question today, who will be talking about economic globalization, inequality, and debt. So that all follows on pretty logically. In the meantime, please give Professor Stiglitz a nice giant LSE clap.